Hello, everyone. This is the CAG podcast again, and we're continuing our study of Klingon. I don't want to say religion because they kind of killed their gods, but mythology, more or less.
Sure.
And to understand Klingon mythology, we have to dig into Klingon history to understand where Klingons are coming from and what led to the development of their greatest, you almost want to say messiah, but leader, Kalis. So, Troy, you want to outline some Klingon history for us and talk about it a bit?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's exactly the place to start. The first thing that people think of when they think of Klingon history is Kalis, right? I mean, it would be just like on Earth, you know, someone would probably say Muhammad or Jesus or Buddha, you know? I mean, they were the central figures, but they didn't start it all out. They came into the world at a specific time. And if you're at all a believer in fate, then you believe that that time was predestined, or if not, it was very serendipitous. So when I talk about Kalis in the abstract, you know, when I give the brief overview, the first thing I like to do is kind of go back a bit and talk about the Klingon civilization, where it was and what the prehistory. And then once we get to that time frame, we'll talk about the birth of Kalis, his rise, and some of his great deeds. Does that sound good?
You're the teacher. Where are the students?
Come on. Okay. So when I say go back a little ways, I mean a long way. We're going back about 8,000 years on Klingon. The concept of houses was firmly established at this point in Klingon cult. Settlements grew larger as more successful houses grew and continued to war against one another.
Now, by great houses, you mean family units, not living structures.
You could say, exactly. In some cultures, you might say tribes, extended families, not quite what we would consider to be countries with borders, but more, this is our hunting land and we're moving into yours. That's the kind of struggle that we see. And honestly, this kind of a dynamic is very, very universal. It was true on Earth, it was true on Klingon, and although they may not admit it, the Vulcans had a prehistory that was, yeah. You're absolutely. We're not talking about physical buildings. We're talking about families, extended families, tribes. So these settlements grew larger as more successful houses grew and continued to war against one another. As the great houses grew, it became more and more difficult to incorporate one's enemies into one's own house after defeating them. Rival houses were simply too large for such forced alliances. And attempts made to unify houses by force resulted in bloody civil wars that tore the newly unified houses apart and destroyed both sides. According to legend, a Klingon warlord named Kargosh hit upon the idea of bringing different houses together without forcing them to become one house. Instead, as individuals and families joined a house, so could houses join together to form a nation, working together for their mutual benefit. It was a radical idea, but Kargosh made it work through a combination of cunning diplomacy and persuasion at the point of a sword. The heir to his empire was allowed to keep their house and their title so long as they swore an oath of loyalty to the House of Kargosh. More importantly, houses were allowed to join Kargosh's new alliance of their own free will, and some did once they saw the potential benefit. Kargosh and his allies are believed to have the Klingon city that still bears his name, the first true city-state on Klingon. Although the city has been conquered, destroyed, and rebuilt many times over thousands of years, Kargosh's original alliance lasted for generations before the tides of war brought down him, which is lost to the mists of legend. The idea of city-states spread throughout Klingon society, and other houses began to form alliances of their own. From these new city-states emerged the first true signs of modern Klingon ideals of nobility, along with blood feuds between houses, which began during this time. Although Klingon city-states were successful, they also grew too rapidly for the meager resources of their territory to sustain them. This led to the first large-scale wars in Klingon history. A city-state and alliance fought each other for control of valuable land and resource. Vast armies battled on the plains of Khotnos, and city-states rose and fell based on the outcome of those battles. One of the bloodiest and fiercest battles of this time was the Battle of Tong Vey. Tong Vey was the ancient city-state that refused the advances of a warrior named Sompek to join his new and growing empire. Sompek led an army of 10,000 Klingon warriors to lay siege to Tong Vey for months. Legends speak of the vast sea of warriors that broke against the walls of Tong Vey. Starvation and disease gripped the populace of the city as they held out against Sompek's army for as long as they could. Their continued defiance to his will only angered the emperor more and more. Finally, after months of siege, the people of Tong Vey had no choice but to surrender to Sompek and agree to join his empire. The emperor accepted their surrender, but as the gates of the city opened, he ordered his troops to kill every inhabitant of the city and to burn Tong Vey to the ground so no sign of the defiant city would survive. Sompek's destruction of Tong Vey set the tone for millennia of Klingon history as petty empires rose and fell across Khotno. The leaders of great houses schemed and forged alliances, raising new warlords to rule over collections of powerful city-states. New empires warred with the old, falling before their might or toppling them and taking their place. Although many legendary Klingon heroes appear in this period, Klingon culture acknowledges it as a dark time when emperors and leaders had no understanding of honor or the obligations of a leader to his people, as shown by the heroes like Jaduch and Kargash. The so-called Time of Tyrants is often the subject of tragic Klingon opera, where cruel leaders and warlords are brought down by their own lack of honor. Then came the time of Kalak. Some 1,500 years ago, a figure arose that would change Klingon culture and society forever. Kalesh was born to a common family ruled by the tyrant Malor. Malor was known as the cruel and despotic leader who built his empire on conquest and cunning, oppressing his people with heavy taxes and other demands to supply Malor's own army and to fill his palace with luxury. After their father died in Malor's army, Kalesh's brother Morath attempted to claim his father's sword, but Kalesh reminded him that the sword belonged to the firstborn son. So Morath threw his father's sword into the sea, saying that if he could not possess it, then neither would Kalesh. And Kalesh held his father's lifeless body in his arm. He could not believe what his brother had done. Kalesh looked into the ocean and wept, for the sword was all he had left of his, and the sea filled with his tears and flooded beyond its shores. Not long after this, Morath went to the great hall of Malor to ask the emperor for money to support the family land. To gain the money, Morath told the egotistical tyrant his father supported Malor and that the emperor's people loved him. When Kalesh found out about Morath's lie, he insisted on returning the money to Malor. Morath refused, leading the two brothers to fight. According to Klingon legend, Kalesh and Morath battled for 12 days and 12 nights before Morath surrendered, realizing his brother was right. When they attempted to return the money to the tyrant emperor, Malor was offended. He ordered Morath killed and the family lands confiscated. The two brothers fought to escape, and Morath gave his life so Kalesh might live, having learned the lesson of honor at last. Kalesh escaped into the mountains surrounding Malor's city, where he lived alone for many years as an exile and hermit. According to the legend, one day, while pondering his fate, Kalesh was struck by inspiration, the idea of a code of honor as a way to govern the actions of true Klingons formed in his mind. With the fires of honor burning in his heart and mind, Kalesh forged the first Batleth in the fires of Kristak, a volcano in those mountains. When the weapon was ready, Kalesh returned home. He fought his way through 100 warriors to reach Malor's throne room, where he challenged Malor to face him in battle. Kalesh slew the tyrant after a duel that lasted for 7 days and nights. With the defeat of Malor, his people hailed Kaelas as a hero and a liberator. It is said his first act after Malor's defeat was to return to his family farm, where he used the Botleth to harvest all of the fields in a single day, ensuring his family would have food to eat and money to support them. Kaelas then assumed the role of emperor and rallied the people around him. They quickly swore fealty to their liberator, and word of Kaelas's victory spread. When news of Malor's death and Kaelas's ascension reached the nearby city-states, their rulers thought they sensed weakness in the commander-turned-emperor. They prepared to invade and seized Malor's former territory for their own. Some few city-states, swayed by Kaelas's philosophy of honor, chose to join him. Kaelas himself led the city's warriors to defend it. His small army withstood an assault from a force more than 10 times their size at Three Turns Bridge, where Kaelas is said to have held the pass entirely by himself. The blood of his enemies flowed so freely, the river there is still known as the River of Blood. After his victory at Three Turns Bridge, the noble houses agreed to support Kaelas, and he won the respect of friends and enemies alike. Nobles flocked to swear fealty to the new emperor. Those who continued to defy Kaelas's power soon felt it for themselves as the empire continued to grow. As the years passed, Kaelas's empire became larger and more powerful on Cotna. Kaelas conquered and unified the whole world under his rule, creating the first Klingon Empire. Many legends grew up around Kaelas and his successors, and Klingons often regard the first empire as a kind of golden age of honor and heroism. Kaelas lived to be a great age. It is said that in his later years, Kaelas feared his fame and greatness were a liability to the empire rather than an asset. He worried that his people were growing dependent upon losing the fire of their hearts. So Kaelas chose to abdicate as emperor and depart without naming a successor, so his people would learn what it meant to be Klingons again. Before he left, Kaelas pointed to a star in the night sky and said he would return from there one day. Then he departed the imperial city, leaving his weapons and armor behind, and vanished into the wilderness, never to be heard from again. But the spirit of Kaelas lives in every Klingon who remembers his name and hears tales of his glory. And there you go. That would be the introduction to the life of Kaelas and his legend.
One thing I'm a little confused on is, after he defeated Molar, the people thought of him as a commander and new emperor, yet you talked that he stayed in a cave for several years.
Yeah, he was seen as a military commander. Obviously, one would have to be, right, in order to lead an insurrection against a leader.
Did he have an army backing him?
Well, see, that's an interesting question, and that's one that's hotly debated. You'll notice that there are many times throughout this narrative where it's implied that he was alone. Other times it's implied that he was with an army. The size of that army rises and falls depending on the telling. This is one of those things where legend is legend and reality may not be perfectly equal. A lot of times in the telling, people like to make it that Kaelas did everything single-handedly, and other times people say, well, that's a little bit unreasonable. Maybe he led an army and he was responsible for the victory, but he didn't do it by himself. And that's true too in if you think of Earth history, there was a great battle that was very similar to the battle of the River of Blood. And that would be the Battle of Thermopylae, where oftentimes people talk about these 300 Spartans who turned back a whole army themselves. But when you really dig into the history, it was 300 Spartans and an Athenian navy was fighting too, and there was Thessalonians fighting with them, and there was many others involved. But there's legend, and then there's you'll also notice a very key element missing, and I'll get into it in a future story when we start digging into the individual legend. But one legend has it that the battle after Malor's death, he fought with his future wife Lucara. So the two of them stood against a great arm. How that fits in with the army that was with him or may have been with him, I'm not entirely certain. But it makes for great stories and certainly some great opera.
That's what I was going to ask you next, is how does the Lady Lucara fit into these legends?
Yeah. Lady Lucara is kept alive in the tradition of the wedding ceremony. And as I said, she was ostensibly someone of noble birth, perhaps from Melor's own lineage. That is just speculation on my part. But it is believed that she joined Kaelas at about the time he vanquished Melor, and that's where the legend, perhaps she helped him to fight in order to escape, to regroup with his army.
The legend that I've heard of Lady Lucara and her meeting with Kaelas is that Kaelas had come to her father's kingdom, castle, whatever you want to call it, and with his army, and they took refuge in it from the forces of Molar, who then proceeded to siege the castle and demand that Kaelas be brought out to him and so he could do away with him. Mm-hmm. And the two of them, the Lady Lucara and Kaelas, defended the hall of that castle from the forces of Molar throughout the night. And after the bloodlust was sated, their relationship was fermented.
Consummated.
Yeah, put together.
Yeah.
I knew there was a word I was looking for.
Yeah. That is another legend. You're absolutely right. The question sometimes of when events happened, where they took place, sometimes are hotly debated. But there is an opera that tells that story too. You're absolutely right. It's a very romanticized type of story. Humans think oftentimes of things like Romeo and Juliet when they think of that story. Similar ideas of romance, although what a Klingon calls romance and what a human calls romance are two very different. I don't think a Klingon would really, to be honest, very little sense.
On the flip side, though, while you were describing the early history of the Klingon Empire and how houses were coming together, the tale of Romeo and Juliet came into my mind from the Klingon perspective of bringing the houses together.
Bringing houses together, exactly. And that is probably the key takeaway, and I'm glad you picked up on that, because the recurring theme throughout not only the story of Kaelas, but the prehistory and the post-history is continually trying to reunify the empire, right? Starting with, you know, all these separate families that are warring, right? To larger and larger city-states and nations also warring against you. They're led by sometimes very corrupt leaders, because power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Politics ruins everything. And finally, a realization by somebody that there needs to be unity, that yes, the competition, the spirit of competition is good for the spirit, but this constantly destroying one another is not, which is the beginnings of this way of life, this warrior's mentality, this way of honor that I think won the unity of the empire more than any stories of battle. Personally, in my opinion, I think that the Klingon people were inspired by not only the great strength of, but his leadership as a leader who serves his people and serves the common good and serves a way of life, not just himself. It's much easier to follow a leader like that than it is to follow a tyrant. You follow a tyrant out of fear. You follow a hero out of respect. And that's probably one of the best distillations of the message of Kaelas as a leader.
As a leader, we also have to remember that Kaelas was a bit of a messiah to his people. He was bringing a message of warrior's honor that the people could look at. Oh, this is a good idea. This is a way of living. This is a way of life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it really has served. What happens, though, what we've seen in Klingon history over the generations, though, is exactly what it seems that Kaelas at the end of his life was concerned about. without a unifying enemy to fight against, they tend to kind of start to fall apart again. His concern was, what's going to happen when I just die? You know, who takes my place? Well, you know what? I'm going to let them fight that out right now. That's what needs to happen. But there always needs somebody in the successor, you know, as the successor, as the leader, so to speak. You could make the argument then that, well, isn't it better that we have the Council of Great Houses with one chancellor unifying them rather than, you know, a single all-powerful emperor? Don't know. Again, that's maybe a little too political for me to kind of wrap my head around. All I know is this was Kalis's idea at the time. And who knows, it might have completely degenerated after his death had it not then been for the Herc invasion, which again redistilled or reinvigorated the unity of the Klingon people against a common enemy. And that enemy became legendary in and of itself, because when the Herc left Kaltnos, they were out there somewhere. So now we know our enemy is out there. We need to, you know, unify as an empire here and start heading out there where the battles are, and thus the galactic expansion.
Which makes me think of a World War One song. Out there, we are going out there.
Yep, that's exactly right. And these things tend to go in cycles, right? So once they get out there and they start to expand their empire, you again have houses taking claims to territories within the galaxy, and then the fighting starts again. Lose sight of their unity until they run into even larger forces like the Federation, which leads to the time of T'Kuvma. And that's another story for another time. And that leads us in, starts to lead us into our mind.
Yeah, one has to wonder where the, with Kalis's teaching of the way of the warrior, how does the greed of the houses keep being manifested?
Well, that's kind of like saying, how is it that any human religious individual continues to fall short? That's just nature, right? Everything in the universe tends towards disorder, and you can have ideals, that doesn't mean you live them out perfect. And different people have different levels of faith in the philosophy that they follow, and there are just some that don't. Let's face it, there are still leaders of the Klingon Empire who do not have honor. They pay lip service to honor. You know, they take their seat of leadership and they talk about Kalis and they talk about honor, but they don't really have any belief that Kalis even existed, let alone follow in his precept. And they do what they want and they hide it from their people. But eventually somebody notices and somebody challenges them, and somebody perhaps of greater honor takes their place, one hopes.
After Kalis left, how was his word spread to his people? Were there institutions that taught the word of Kalis, or?
Legend has it that Lady Lucara started the Order of the Ba'leth.
Shortly after Kalis left, yeah.
To keep the legends alive, but that you could think of that as more of a military arm, right? Whereas clerical arm formed based on, you know, the idea that we need to get to that point of light, because that's where Kalis will come from. And that point of light, of course, was the star around which planet Boreth. Boreth.
Who is it, I think?
I forget my astronomy, but that's where they put their monastery. So you have the clerics teaching the legends and the history. And of course, you have the sword, the Order of the Ba'leth, you know, trying to... So if you think about it this way, if we're going to do an analogy for the humans, okay? You have your clerics of Boreth, that would be like your church, okay? And the Order of the Ba'leth would be kind of like your Knights Templar. That would be a great analogy.
But we also see in Klingon society that if you're not a warrior and you're not a cleric, mm-hmm. the teachings of Kalis still have meaning for you, in that farmers are said to attack the soil to bring forth crops as a prize.
Is there not a constant battle for the farmer against the pests and the parasites?
And that's just one example. the teachings of Kalish manifest themselves through all walks of Klingon society as a means to live your life, whatever you're doing.
Yeah. An Earth culture that kind of mirrors this is the people of Japan. The Bushido Code translates directly from their military to the business world and to the scholastic world in every place. Being excellent, fighting a battle even against one's own will, to do the best that you can, to produce as much as you can to strengthen the empire. You bring personal honor to yourself, you bring honor to your family by bringing to the empire. It's kind of the essence of all philosophy and religion, right? You have a greater focus. There is a greater power, right? There is you, there is your family, there is the empire.
We see a lot of this in the stage play, The Klingon Christmas Carol, where Scrooge has to undergo a rite of ascension to recapture his Klingon heritage.
Yes, and see, that's exactly it. The lesson we learned from Scrooge is that this is someone without honor. He put comfort and wealth and above what a Klingon would consider far more important matters. One of the things he didn't want to do was fight. He knew he was unskilled and he was afraid to lose. And he didn't want to go through the second rite of ascension because he didn't want to go through the pain of the pain sticks. He knew he was a humbug, to use the human translation. But he came to realize through the course of the story that these things were easier, but they were not better. And they did not enrich his life. They just made it easier. And easier is not better. Anything worth having is worth working.
And here is a moneylender who's taking pride in being a moneylender, but learns that the way of the warrior is a better way to live his life and eventually adopts it.
I would argue that there is no dishonor inherently in being a moneylender. Commerce is necessary. It is just a part of the interactions of life. But there is
an honor. You gotta have money to build the ships.
Exactly. But there is an honorable way to go about it. And better to lose a few darsecs than dishonestly take darsecs you don't have coming to you. And there is also a very honorable reason to give away, to advance a cause. There are warriors that do not have the financial benefits of some of the great houses. That does not make them any less honorable. And they doesn't mean that they're not a great asset, but sometimes it requires investment. So you invest time and energy and training and darsecs and so forth into the less fortunate financially so that they can become great warriors in the future and bring greater honor and inevitably wealth to the empire in the future, and everyone benefits. So let's talk a little bit about the Feklari, okay?
I have to ask what they are.
Yeah, see, and a lot of people do. There is a great deal of question about what the Feklari are.
Feklar. Yeah, okay, yeah. The demons.
Yeah, well, that's the question. Are the Feklari, are they actually demons like Feklar in a literal sense? Or were they, how would I put it, an arm of Molor's royal guard that called themselves Demon War? That's another theory that has been postulated.
It also sounds like they could be a cult.
Could be, absolutely. But it does sound like they were somehow associated with Molor, because legend has it that Kalis vanquished Molor and the Feklari. But therein lies the problem. To say that he vanquished the Feklari is great, but that doesn't tell us if they were an army, you know, that patterned themselves after demons, or they were actual demons. You know, if he, you know, did some sort of exorcism, who knows? You know, there is a belief too that, like the Herc, they might have been some sort of extraterrestrial or even interdimensional being that were propping up Molor for whatever reason. And that's a question we don't know. if either of those latter options is a possibility, it might even be an insight to what brought the Herc to Cult Notion in the first place. And then there's, of course, a lot of questions about if prehistoric Kultnos was visited by aliens like the Herc, and if the Fechlari were among them, is that where a lot of our advanced technology came, our warp drives and so forth? It's not very clear.
The Klingon Empire was supposed to have gotten the technology a lot faster than it took the Earthlings to develop it.
And it does seem to have come up very spontaneously. So some people think that the Klingons, when they were no longer, when they were more unified, there was, of course, this great growth of focus on the arts and sciences and so forth, which, of course, advance the Empire. But it's also possible that in so doing, they were also doing some reverse engineering of this alien technology. There is one theory, and I have to admit, I kind of lean towards it myself, that the first cloaking device may have come from either the Herc or, you know, potentially the Fechlari. And when you look at the ships that were used by the houses in the time of T'Kuvma brought out a sarcophagus ship that had the first cloaking device, as far as we know, historically. If that's the case, then it was an old technology that was hidden away by his house and presented in such a way as to help reunify the Klingon people. So again, talking about that cycle of division and reunification for the Klingon. But then also, T'Kuvma's successor also reunified the Klingon military and said, okay, all these different houses with all these different ships, it's time to start bringing all that technology together again. And what does that do? That strengthens the Empire as a whole against a common enemy, the Federation.
Well, let's go back to the Fechlari for a second.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding of them was that they were the guardians of Greythor.
Greythor.
Yep. And you guys are talking like they were the guardians of Molar. In other words, they were in the real world, not in the spiritual world.
Yeah. And that basically comes from the line from the Pakbath that Kaelas overthrew Molar and the Fechlari. And that's not a lot to hang a mythos. It's very difficult to determine what the nature of this Fechlari are. That sounds an awful lot like Fechlar, so there must be a connection. But some who don't believe in a spiritual realm to begin with say, well, that was just a standing army that took the name of the demon army, so to speak. And there's others that say, no, it sounds like that was the Fechlari of Greythor were actually involved with Molar, and Molar was some sort of a spiritual sorcerer or something. What is the truth? I don't know. Maybe it's somewhere in between. That's why others since then, especially since the time of the discovery of the Bajoran wormhole, have started to say, well, we know that there are extra-dimensional creatures out there for which time is not the same as it is for us. Maybe what we consider to be these demons of the air, the Fechlari, those that come from Greythor, maybe Greythor is just another alternate dimension, and they, you know, have reached through and influenced our past. I don't know what to tell you. These are all just theories, and I have to be open-minded to all of them.
I need to take you a step back again. Mm-hmm. You threw out this term, this title of a book, the Pakbak, and I don't know how many of our listeners know what that is.
Yep. So this is I really don't like to call it this, but it is sometimes the easiest way to explain it. In a lot of ways, it is like a Klingon Bible, okay? It is a bit fragmentary, okay, as ancient writings tend to be.
Written in verse.
It is written in verse, and incomplete verse at that. That's what makes it very challenge. Not only do we have to try to interpret the verses that we have, but we have to imagine what goes in the gaps in between, which is a big part of what we do at Borath.
But what is it?
So it's a collection of writings, of ancient writings from, well, to say when it was from is also a bit of debate. Yeah, it's believed to be from the time of Caleb, but scientists have debated that, philosophers have debated that, secularists have speculated other hypotheses, but most spiritually minded Klingons believe that, yeah, it comes from, not written by Kalesh himself. We don't have any actual writings in his hand, so it would have been written by his followers, his descendants, and so.
Most religions' Bibles are not written by the god or gods.
Right.
That they propose to talk about.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So it's definitely what we can agree on, what I think all scholars and philosophers, clerics agree on, is it does represent the oldest existing writings that we have in our possession of the in Klingon culture. Whether or not they go, how far back they go, we could argue. Yeah, exactly. It's the closest thing we have to a primary source.
So if you get a chance, I think the Klingon Language Institute actually has copies of the Pakpak available in both English and Klingon.
Yep.
Depending on your comfortability with the language.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I have a copy myself. It's my primary reading.
This is Jorn for the CAG podcast. Tonight's guest has been Troy Pacelli, or Kartan, as he's known in the Klingon Assault Group, along with Jim. Say hi, Jim.
Hello.
See, he's there. And next time, we'll bring you more on who Kalis was, what he did, and why he's important to Klingons.
Yep.
Kapla.